Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Brian Lehrer's Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, March 15th. I'm Bridget Bergen, politics reporter for WNYC and Gothamist, filling in for Brian today. And now we go to Brian's weekly series with The Green Space called Punishment and Profit. It's all about the business side of the prison industry. The question guiding these segments is, who profits when people get put away? Every Tuesday evening through May 4th, The Green Space, in partnership with the advocacy group Worth Rises, is holding a virtual panel discussion about one aspect of the business side of the prison industry. And Brian previews those weekly discussions here on the show. Last week, Brian talked about companies who provide the physical stuff to prisons, like furniture and restraint equipment. Today, we're going to talk about something less tangible, but equally as essential to the lifeblood of mass incarceration. That's data and surveillance technology. Things like facial recognition, fingerprinting, and software that law enforcement uses to set bail or identify supposed gang affiliations. This kind of technological surveillance is a billion-dollar industry, and it's only growing. With me now are Bianca Tylik, executive director of the nonprofit advocacy organization Worth Rises, and Albert Fox Kahn, the founder and executive director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project at the Urban Justice Center, a New York-based civil rights and privacy group. He's also a fellow at the Engelberg Center for Innovation Law and Policy at NYU School of Law. Bianca, Albert, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having
us. Hi, how are you? Very nice to be with you this morning.
Now, there are two broad types of surveillance technologies we'll be talking about in this segment, those used by the police to track and arrest people, and the other which are used by jails and prisons to keep track of people once they're inside the system. How would you say these two categories are used together, Bianca?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think one in many ways feeds off the other, and often they're actually the same technology. So if you take, for example, risk assessment tools. Risk assessment tools are used, they are often provided by corporations, sometimes foundations. They have these algorithms built into them, and they tell courts whether or not someone should be released, for example, on bail while they await pretrial. And they claim to measure the risk of flight. All they really do is actually measure the risk that somebody has had contact with policing, which is highly racialized. But those same exact tools that are used to determine whether somebody should be eligible for bail are also used inside of prisons and jails to determine whether somebody is a high risk of violence and should be in a maximum security facility. It determines where somebody might do their time, which also determines what programs they might have available to them. So it's actually the very same tools that are used across these different aspects of the system.
Albert, your advocacy group has been working to make the general public more familiar with these kinds of surveillance police departments use. Why has that been such a challenge, especially in New York City?
Well, in addition to being one of the most expansive and invasive surveillance states in the country, New York is also one of the most opaque. You know, the NYPD has systematically thwarted public oversight for decades, and they've done this in a number of ways. They've fought to create a number of exceptions to freedom of information law, trying to push back against the normal tools that journalists, advocates, and you know, everyday New Yorkers use to understand how our government operates. But then we've also seen the NYPD using millions of dollars in private funding through its supposedly charitable foundation, and through federal funding, circumventing the normal appropriations process at the city council, so that, you know, until we worked to pass a law here in New York called the POST Act last year, there is absolutely no accountability for the tools the NYPD purchased with non-city funds, even if they were being used to track and arrest New Yorkers.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of that city council legislation and later in this segment. But Bianca, police departments across the country would say these tools are objective and don't have the same biases as, say, people. I know your group has written a lot about the algorithmic biases when it comes to these tools. Can you explain to us a little bit more about how it works and maybe use facial recognition as an example?
Sure. So the example that I was using before, risk assessment tools, is a great one. And risk assessment tools came up almost a century ago. And when they first came in, and they were meant to measure, as I said, risk of reoffending or anything like that, they actually used race as one of the inputs. Over the years, that obviously became something that, you know, was frowned upon. And so now we use proxies for race, things like zip codes that people live in or the number of times somebody's been arrested, not convicted, but just arrested by police for anything. We use many of these aspects of criminal history and location as essentially proxies for race. And so we have those same exact outcomes in policing. You see it in gang databases where, you know, in New York, more than 95% of those in gang databases are black and brown people, which is, it's completely based on things, again, like your neighborhood, who you hang mm-hmm. out with, or some very, very obscure data points, right? In terms of facial recognition, which is, you know, a technology that is now being introduced by some of our major tech companies, you are seeing some really, really stark differences in how these technologies interpret black and brown folks as opposed to white folks. In particular, when it comes to white men, you have rates of accurate facial recognition that are north of 90-95%. When it comes to women of color, that figure is just 65%. And so what we have seen time and time again are actually facial recognition systems incorrectly identify black and brown people that have actually led to arrests.
I want to talk about a high-profile case of the NYPD's use of that technology over the summer when the police showed up at the apartment of a Black Lives Matter protester seeking his arrest. They used helicopters, riot gear, police dogs, and his alleged offense, we later found out, was using a bullhorn too close to a police officer's ear. Albert, can you talk about how facial recognition software was used in this case and more broadly by the department in general? And I think it was one of my Gotham's colleagues who actually figured out this technology was used in this case.
Yeah, that was actually George Joseph at Gothamist and WNYC who noticed that in one of the bystander photos, there was a printout from the NYPD's facial identification section that one of the officers who was storming this entire block was holding. And you know, the activist here, DREC, also known as Derek Ingram, is an amazing, you know, political leader, activist here in New York, works with Warriors in the Garden. And, you know, he was accused of pointing a bullhorn at a police officer. That was his only the only accusation. And officers then, you know, after using allegedly facial recognition to track him down, also using social media as they increasingly do, they then deployed, you know, SWAT teams, helicopters, all of these different officers. And I think it's really crucial here to remember that when we talk about the risk of error with facial recognition and these other surveillance systems, we're not just talking about the risk of, you know, a wrongful arrest or even a false conviction. We're talking about the risk of all the forms of police violence that come when communities of color are forced to interact with the NYPD. We're talking about the risk of SWAT team at your door or even a knee to the neck. And so surveillance is often the entry point to interactions with a criminal justice system that is built on systemic violence against BIPOC New Yorkers. And so I think that risk, that really visceral harm has to be very central to this conversation that, you know, this technology promotes bias. Yes, this technology, you know, is invasive and erodes our privacy, but it's really putting people in harm's way.
Bianca, facial recognition may be something new, but fingerprinting is certainly decades old. Last year, the New York City Council urged the NYPD to expunge many New Yorkers from the city's fingerprinting database. They agreed, but the database has only grown since then. why should anyone want officers to give up fingerprint data when the police and much of the public see it as an important tool in their work?
I think it's for many of the same reasons, that I just sort of mentioned, which is keeping people in these data systems makes them more likely to be approached by cops, even when they have nothing that is related to, to incidents of crime, right? All of a sudden, there's, a crime that happens, let's say, in a CVS, and, you've been in that CVS, and your fingerprints are in the system. It makes you susceptible to that violence that he was just talking about, right? And so there's actually more systems, I would say, even being created now, to voice printing, which many people may not know about. People inside prisons and jails, especially in New York, are being required to give a voice print in order to use the phone to call their loved ones. Well, those voice prints are being turned into databases sold to other law enforcement. And when they leave prison or jail, they're not removed or scrubbed from that data, that voice print data. And not to mention that the technology the accuracy of voices is questionable at best. And to take it one step further into sort of, the conversation about protesters in particular being targets, these voice print systems inside prisons and jails don't just track the voices of people who are incarcerated. They actually also track the voices of people who they are calling. And if you are a person on the outside that is speaking to somebody inside a prison or jail and more than one person at the same facility, you will be tracked and flagged for additional surveillance, which means as an advocate, as a social provider, as a family member with more than one loved one inside, you are more likely to be surveilled than other folks. And so that is like tormenting folks who are providers, who are protesters, who are organizers. And it's, that's been happening around facial recognition, the labeling of people as like black extremists, and all these things time and time and time again to quell the protest.
And if I could just quickly add, Richard, in New York, we claim to be a sanctuary city. We claim to protect undocumented New Yorkers from ICE. But the truth is that New York City's fingerprint database is shared in real time with the New York State Police, which in turn is shared with the FBI database, which is completely accessible to ICE. So we have this lip service to protecting undocumented communities. But then the reality is that fingerprint data can be used by ICE to fuel their deportation efforts here in New York. And so much of the data that we're talking about, it's not just abuse by the NYPD and other city agencies, but all of the federal agencies that they then share that data with, agencies that even under the Biden administration are still deporting New Yorkers every single day.
Albert, you brought up the POST Act earlier. Can you talk a little bit more about what the POST Act requires from the NYPD?
Sure. The POST Act is part of a growing national movement to no longer allow the police to control these questions over surveillance. So the POST Act was just a very minimal first step. It said that the NYPD had to tell us what systems it was using, because some of these systems, very invasive, biased systems, they would be used for a decade before anyone actually knew they were being placed in our communities. Mm-hmm. And so the POST Act said, you have to actually tell us what systems you use, how you're using them, how that information is being stored. And, like with the fingerprint reader, who are you sharing it with? And, there were a few systems that we learned about for the first time because of the POST Act, like the fact that the NYPD has tools to track cryptocurrency and identify the owner, that it has systems that are used to set up fake social media profiles so they can friend people and see posts that would otherwise not be public. But the NYPD also systematically tried to fight this law. They gave us a lot of policies that were, riddled with errors, that were filled with boilerplate language. And we saw more than, 8,000 people submit comments in response to this, saying that these policies were deeply broken, that these were not actually complying with the law.
The social media example feels so potent, because I think we can all wrap our heads around what you know, a fake social media account, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, would look like. But can you talk through a little bit of an example of how they've used that?
Well, with the social media account, you know, we've seen this effort since, you know, the successful rollback of much of Stop and Frisk. We've seen the NYPD trying to replace the abuse of analog stop and frisk with these digital dragnets. One of the biggest ones is the gang database, which grew to be over 42,000 New Yorkers, as Bianca mentioned, you know, over 98.5% of whom were non-white. So this was basically a racialized dragnet. And one of the ways that they've been filling that gang database is by using these posts to create these fake profiles, friend people, then, you know, instead of needing to get a warrant or get a subpoena to track what people are posting, they can just look at the friends feed. And then because of the software they're getting, one officer can conceivably create dozens, hundreds, maybe even thousands of fake profiles and use that to track, you know, countless New Yorkers, overwhelmingly BIPOC New Yorkers. And so, you know, we've seen the power and the danger of these fake accounts in, you know, national elections to spread disinformation, but they're also a powerful tool to take away even the minimal protections that our private social media posts have.
Albert, I want to talk about another piece of relevant news this month. Police Commissioner Shea announced that the NYPD would be expanding its ShotSpotter program to monitor large swaths of the city. That's the technology used to monitor gunshots. Why is it controversial?
Well, I think we have to start off by that with that description. It claims to monitor gunshots, but the truth is it monitors neighborhoods. These are highly sensitive directional microphones that are placed in low-income communities and communities of color to monitor for what they think sounds like gunshots. But the problem is there's no real evidence that the technology works. You know, this is part of the pattern we see with surveillance salesmanship, that you get these claims that, oh, the artificial intelligence does X or it does Y. But when you look for the actual third party verified evidence that these claims are, you know, are reality, there isn't a lot there. But what we have seen with ShotSpotter is plenty of cases where they got it wrong, where they couldn't tell the difference between a firework or a car backfire and a gunshot. And so what that translates into is a lot of people being stopped. It's one of the leading justifications for Black and Brown New Yorkers being stopped by the NYPD under the new stop and frisk guidelines. And also at the same time, you know, these microphones are so sensitive that they can listen to what people are saying in their own apartments if the window is open. They can hear what people are saying on the street. And you know, the company has also been accused of fabricating evidence in one case up in Rochester where a man was charged with shooting police officers. He had been shot by police officers. That they knew. He was in the hospital and they claimed, well, he shot first. And there wasn't any evidence that he had actually shot at them. And so what this man claims in his lawsuit is that ShotSpotter manufactured a gunshot report to make it to give the police evidence that he had actually shot before they had fired three bullets at him, that they had heard four gunshots instead of three. And he's now suing them after he was acquitted of these charges in his criminal case. And so I have to ask, you know, if this technology isn't proven to work, if there are allegations that it gets it wrong all the time, if there are claims that they're manufacturing evidence, then why is Commissioner Shea investing so much money to blanket New York neighborhoods with these microphones? This to me is just a lose-lose in every possible way.
Albert, thank you for that. Bianca, as advocates call on governments to defund police departments, some worry less money for police departments means more layoffs and reliance on technology rather than human beings. With all we've laid out here, is that a concern to you?
Sure. I think it's always a concern when sort of we put advocacy demands in the hands of law enforcement and allow them to define how that's going to happen, right? The reality is that when we say defund the police, yes, we mean less police on the streets. We also mean less surveillance. So that's not necessarily the solution, right, that we would like to see, but that's what makes it so important for legislators, elected officials, to not simply take high-level comments and demands made by advocates, but to actually involve advocates and the community in the process of developing the solution, so that it's not, so that the police that are walking around the streets are not replaced by some form of AI surveillance. So it is just remarkably important that process of finding solutions to depolice our communities are done in concert with communities and advocates, and that, you know, electeds, as I said, legislators, police don't find a new way to police us.
Mm. And we're going to try, Albert, I'm going to cut you off because I want to try to get one more caller in here before we have to wrap up. So I want to go to Derek on the Upper West Side. Derek, welcome to WNYC. What did you want to add to this?
Thanks for taking my call. One of your guests, a lady, mentioned that this Leo Systems claimed on their website that they speak Emni. I'm guessing that that was referring to something called the IMEI, Ivan Mary Echo Ivan, which is a unique identifying address of all cellular devices, so that any cell phone or smartwatch, anything that communicates in cellular land, has a unique identifying number. And that's how people and devices are tracked. I think that's what that Leo system is trying to say, that they can break down the codes and track devices. That's what the police often use. And just want to mention, I used to be a teacher in South Bronx. The NYPD, back in the 90s, they used to go around and collect all the yearbooks from the Black and Puerto Rican high schools and use the photos in the yearbooks for their photo arrays for criminal identification, without knowledge to the students, of course. Mm. And I think the city council stopped that right around the time that Rudy Crewe became chancellor.
Wow. That is so, so disturbing. Derek, thank you. And let me turn to Bianca, because I think Derek was making a point to something that you had explained. Was Derek correct in his understanding of how this company was marketing the technology?
No, actually. So it's a very, Leo Technologies has a product called Virus, and Virus mm-hmm. specifically is real-time intelligence that listens into just wall phones, like in a prison or jail. Has nothing to do with like separate devices, but wall phones. Okay. And it uses keywords and phrases.
And you said it spoke inmate?
Yes, and that's their language.
So INMATE, quote, inmate. That's what you were saying. It says that they are saying their technology speaks, which, as you raised,
correct.
Has many implications.
That's not a language. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, we still appreciate, Derek, your contribution and your perspective, particularly having been a New York City teacher. And we're going to have to leave it there for today with Bianca Tylik, Executive Director of Worth Rises, and Albert Fox Kahn, Executive Director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, about the data and information systems that track individuals. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.